next case for argument this morning is Hickman Transportation against Chu.
Good morning, Your Honors. I will focus my initial argument on the critical issue of preemption in this case, the issue by which the district court dismissed 8 of the 10 claims. The law of the preemption doctrine under the Illinois Trade Secret Act is pretty well formulated. The statute which forms the basis for the law is straightforward. It says it's intended to displace conflicting claims to those provided for misappropriation of trade secret. It says contract claims are exempted. That is, they are not displaced by preemption. And it concludes in paragraph B2, this is section 6A, that other civil remedies that are not based upon misappropriation of a trade secret are not affected by the Act. All of the 15 or 16 cases cited by both sides adhere to the analysis that if it's a trade secret claim, or a trade secret claim, if you will, in lamb or sheep's clothing, it will be preempted. But if it is based on a different context, then it's not preempted. This court in the IDEX system case, a 2003 case, applied the preemption doctrine of the Illinois. Actually, it was the Wisconsin Trade Secret Act, but it was the same language, to tortious interference claim, and found under the facts of that case, and each of these 15 cases apply the analysis to the facts of the case, that what was being posited was not a claim for trade secret misappropriation. It noted that the statute was intended only to preempt or prohibit, proscribe claims that were conflicting with trade secret claims. We have a series of cases, Lady Redding, Luciano, Italiani, Automed, MG, Capitals, you know, the judges of this district court, Judge Gettleman, Judge Moran, Judge Pellmeyer, and others, applying the preemption doctrine by going to the
counsel. Does it matter what federal district judges do?
I agree with that.
Not only are they, inferior courts, but they aren't state judges. What we need to know is what state judges do.
And so,
we're here under Erie. So why don't you tell us what state judges do?
Okay. State judges of time and again apply the same analysis. What they do is they look count by count, and they say, as appropriate under the Act, which is pretty straightforward, is this a trade secret misappropriation claim or isn't it? And they analyze those actions, and in so doing, so if there's a tortious interference, I'll give a specific example. If there's a tortious interference that's based on taking trade secrets, that's barred. But if there is also a tortious interference based on taking customers, which is our allegation in this lawsuit, that is not barred.
You're saying that it's a for tortious interference or breach of fiduciary duty or whatever, if there's a smaller circle that deals this with the whatever there is on trade secrets, but if there's a broader circle that encompasses other things besides trade secrets, that is not preempted?
if the other claims would stand independent of the trade secrets, it's not preempted under the statute. And now let's look at the court's, the lower court's analysis in this case. In the two-paragraph opinion, the court barred the 10 VA claims by preemption, but in so doing, it didn't even discuss the claims individually. What noted was that there were trade secret related paragraphs of the complaint that got reincorporated in the later counts. But the later counts were clearly not trade secret counts. The later counts were alleging very different things. Let's start, for example, with count one, which does not reallege the paragraphs of count two, which is the one trade secret count. Count one is a breach of fiduciary duty claim. The evidence adduced, we find 125 paragraph statement facts, almost all of which dealt with issues other than trade secret. They dealt with claims that a joint venture, an entrepreneur who had bought into a business, a 10% and 20% interest, competed with that business, used its resources, paid its employees to run competing businesses, used the funds, used the facts for his competing businesses, doctored documents, forged documents, there's affidavits of people being paid money under the table, not to disclose, and this is, you know, the distinction, not to disclose trade secrets, no, paid money not to disclose that George Chu was running a business within a business, violating his obligations, his fiduciary obligations, tortiously interfering, that's count four, and when you get to the fraud count, I mean, there's cases that talk about fraud as if it's merely a fraud that says we're concealing the fact that we're stealing trade secrets, that's a trade secret. That's preempted under the Trade Secret Act. But the fraud here is forging documents, taking money, misrepresenting that you're running the company as its manager. He contractually has the obligation to be the number one guy in the Chicago office. Instead, he's running a business within a business. You know, in fact, the claims, most of the claims that pick up the allegations of count two as sort of peripheral allegations aren't even against George Chu. So the allegation George Chu misappropriated trade secrets has now been used somehow as converting the basic claims against other defendants for misappropriation, tortious interference, for fraud. They're clearly secondary. So what I would say in summary on preemption is this is not at its core a trade secret case. We have a count. It's a secondary claim. We believe it stands. But the core of this, George Chu doesn't compete because he's got trade secrets. He competes because he's put himself in the position of being a manager, a fiduciary, and it's a classic case of running a business within a business, competing with your own joint venture. So we believe that the eight counts stand against the preemption document. That brings me to the second issue I'd like to argue, which is the restrictive covenant in this case. The lower court, in the one-paragraph opinion, portion of its opinion, dismissed the restrictive covenant that George, the case based on the restrictive covenant, count three of the complaint. In 1989, George Chu entered into a joint venture agreement. He'd been an employee for a few years in Los Angeles and a few years in Chicago, and now he wanted to be an owner. He entered into an agreement that gave him a 10% ownership interest, later increased to 20%, that gave him the primary authority to run. He was the guy running the Chicago office of this national company, indeed international.
What did he invest?
I believe the amount was $10,000 was the initial investment, but I'm not 100% certain of that.
$10,000 for 20% of the Chicago operation doesn't sound like a plausible investment.
Well, he's investing his time and effort.
Well, his time and effort are the kind of thing you invest as an employee. It seems to me that this restrictive covenant under Illinois law may well depend on whether he's characterized as an entrepreneur or as an employee. Do you think a partner in a law firm is a separate entrepreneur if he, say, invests $10,000 on the way to becoming a partner?
Well, of course, many firms don't even have capital buy-ins, but...
Many don't, many do.
Yes.
And those that do, the capital is usually a lot more than $10,000. But we wouldn't describe him as an entrepreneur, would we?
Well, he becomes an entrepreneur in the following sense. It's a joint venture agreement. He is given a share of the profits. He's given a share of the losses. He's been with the company. He has some idea if they're making money or losing money. He's given rights to be bought out. If he dies, or if he leaves, or if he retires, there's provisions that permit him to realize a return on his joint venture. It's clearly an ownership interest, a joint venture ownership interest that cannot be taken away from him. Significantly changed from a new employee. Day to day, if I manage a business and I get 20% of the profits, I'm very differently driven than if I'm a new employee. Whether the consideration, whether he bought in inexpensively, doesn't affect the fact that he is an owner. And of course, it's the court recently addressed the joint venture situation in the restrictive covenant in the H-Now case, H-Now versus Owens, decided this summer. There you have five actually joint ventures, and they entered into restrictive covenants. One of them competed.
That was a simple case compared to this, because all of them brought their own businesses to the table. They had all been entrepreneurs with their own businesses, and they merged.
Right.
Did Chu have an independent shipping business before he entered into this arrangement?
He did not, and I think that makes the non-compete even more necessary. The four entrepreneurs in the J-Now case had business which they were giving over to the joint venture. Here you have somebody joining the business, maybe he bought so cheaply because he brought no business to the company, joining the business and getting rights and management, getting the share of profits, and he brings nothing to the business. So you have an established business. H-Now is a new enterprise. This is an established business that has a history, has customers, has some large customers, and they give an ownership interest to Mr. Chu, and he enters into an agreement in the contract. He says, I won't compete. I won't compete when I'm with the company. I won't compete for 2 years after. And limits it to one state where he is engaging in this business.
What do you look for in that claim? Is this obviously we're way past the injunction? What do you look for as a remedy?
We look for damages for breach of contract. Yes. And in the lower court, this case was dismissed after a pretrial order, after it was ready for trial, after expert witnesses. The expert witness addressed the issue of damages and without going into the detail, the business of these competing enterprises grew from 20,000 to a million a year, so it's not an insignificant business.
One possible characterization of what was going on was that Chu was a franchisee. How does Illinois treat no competition clauses entered into by franchisees.
I think the closest case, which is an Illinois case, is the U-Haul case, 1980 case, U-Haul of Central Illinois versus Hendall. You have two gentlemen become dealers for U-Haul in Pekin, Illinois. There's a restrictive covenant, and the court affirms the restrictive covenant, stating that U-Haul has shown a legitimate interest in seeing that its investment in these dealerships is not used in the service of a competitor. These gentlemen went out and entered into, if you will, side agreements or side dealings with a competitor of U-Haul. The restrictive covenant was challenged and the restrictive covenant was affirmed. Here, there is a substantial investment by Heckney in this business. It, for business reasons, agrees to give 20% to George Chu, and George Chu, in our view, reasonably agrees then that he will not compete for a reasonable time and period with the enterprise in which he's been given an ownership interest.
Would you agree, counsel, that if summary judgment was appropriate on your Trade Secret Act claim, that it was also appropriate on the enforceability of the non-compete claim?
No, I believe that those are separate issues.
They're separate issues, but the elements overlap.
The rationale, which obviously we disagree with on the trade secret claim, is that a trade secret didn't exist and that a trade secret wasn't misappropriated. Very, very different is the issue of whether George Chu competed with his own enterprise, with the enterprise that he had taken a 20% ownership interest in and management responsibility for. So I don't believe there is a tie that makes the results on those two counts coterminous.
What are the trade secrets that you're claiming are being protected here, that you're claiming protection for, and that he stole?
I'll start by saying this is not a perfect trade secret count case, if you will, or not a classic case, because the person in charge of the trade secrets, the guy running the office, the guy charged with protecting trade secrets, protecting confidential information, is the alleged wrongdoer, the proverbial fox in the hen house. But the trade secrets are we have information deleted from our computer, customer information. We have 22 boxes of documents that don't show up till well into the litigation that are taken from the premises, documents with all our customer information. We have software that's taken.
What was proprietary about the customer? And what steps were taken to keep it secret?
And I'm not rebuttal, but let me answer that. What's proprietary, the court said that there's nothing unique or special about the information of this company. The facts of these below, George Benson Chan has asked, is this like every other company? And his answer is, yeah, but in this case it's unique. And we have information about CAT, our largest customer, that's unique, and pricing information. Very briefly, the Trade Secret Act does potentially protect this type of information, data, both technical, non-technical, financial information, etc. The burden that we have of alleging specifically what the trade secrets were, where it's deleted from our computer by the guy running the business, makes this a little different case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Levinson. Mr. Reese.
Good morning, and may it please the court. the first issue on appeal is whether the district court properly entered summary judgment on the non-contract common law claims because they were preempted by the Trade Secrets Act. The answer to that question is yes, and it's yes because as the record developed on summary judgment, all of the conduct and all of the damages in this case relates to a single theory, and that is the theory that the defendants conspired together to misuse Heckman's confidential trade secret information so that they could divert business to themselves or to another company. To answer a few of the questions that were raised earlier, Judge Easterbrook asked about what law or what are there state court cases that control on the preemption issue. I will admit that there are not many in Illinois. This court's opinion in Composite Marine did address preemption and identified the statute as the law and identified the rule that when a claim of trade secrets is alleged, even if it's in the guise of fiduciary duty or unfair competition, as it was in Composite Marine, unless there are...
This is based on the Uniform Trade Secrets Act.
It is.
So how do other jurisdictions understand it?
I've reviewed, I think, most of the cases, and we've cited some of the most on point. We cite the Burbank case from Wisconsin, which applies to the Uniform Act. We cited one case that I believe was not cited by anyone, and I'm mindful of the rule of not citing cases that aren't in the briefs, but is the Pope versus Alberto Culver is a Illinois case. But I think all of the courts have applied the rule, which is the claim based on a theory of trade secret? And I think the case that actually is the most factually on point and really indistinguishable from this one is Judge Moran's opinion in Thomas and Betts.
Yeah, well, as I said to your adversary, the opinions of district judges and $2.50 will get you a cup of coffee. They count for zip.
I appreciate that, but the facts are the same in that at least the scenario is the same.
Again, opinions of district judges count for nothing. They have no precedential force in the Court of Appeals, and they have no authoritative force because they're not state judges. Right? Our decisions count because they have precedential force. Decisions of the state judiciary count because they're authoritative. Decisions of district judges in diversity cases have neither...
I agree.
No different from law review articles.
And that's why I think you'd look first to your own decision in Composite Marine.
No, we look first to the state judiciary.
And
it's state law.
What I'm telling you is that there are not many well-developed cases in Illinois. And, Your Honor, we've looked at whether this is a case that should be certified under Rule 52 for that purpose, and I think the answer to that is no. Certification would be appropriate if the court would be genuinely uncertain about the law and if it's not, wouldn't be determined by fact-specific issues. This is a case which does turn on whether the facts as developed on the record in this case are based on a theory that the defendants conspired to steal trade secrets.
Isn't there a lot more than that, though? If someone is setting up a business on the side, for example, with Platinum or others, that maybe it's they use information or whatever, which, of course, part of the case is that there aren't any trade secrets, but that's beside the point. If they set up a business on the side and it operates and these ideas of paying people under the table not to tell about the fact that there's a business on the side, these are just allegations. Isn't it good beyond trade secrets so that you do have claims that are separate?
The answer to your question, Your Honor, is that might be on a motion to dismiss. So, for example, the test on a motion to dismiss, is there any set of facts that would allow the plaintiff to state a claim? And if the allegations include conduct that might not relate to trade secrets, maybe that would survive a motion to dismiss.
You're talking about summary judgment?
And now that you're summary judgment, which is we are now, is as the record developed, did the plaintiff submit evidence that I think needs to show two elements. Both
is based essentially on a claim.
That's right.
And when you get to this point, we're beyond that, so now you have to come up with some set of facts.
That's right.
And evidence, possible evidence that might create that.
And the test that should be applied is there conduct and damage that would sustain an independent claim. Your Honor asked about damage and asked about the remedy. HECME has presented an expert report and has identified only one measure of damage for their entire case, and that is $1.2 million in lost profits that they claim should have come to them, and they claim that money was diverted because the plaintiffs or the defendants diverted trade secrets or used trade secrets to divert the business. And if there's any question about that, in the record at 193 and 195, HECME actually obtained a default judgment, really a summary judgment against another entity, Platinum Service, that they claim got the business. And in their summary judgment papers against Platinum Service, they identified that the basis of their claim was conversion of trade secrets. And when they submitted their argument on $1.2 million worth of damage, they cited case law that said that you measure that by the value of the trade secrets, which they measured as $1.2 million. The conduct that HECME has identified, they have not identified any conduct.
Well, the conduct that they've identified is certainly wrongful, independent of any trade secrets. Suppose Mayor Brown Rowland Law alleges that the head of its Denver office has used the facilities paid for by this large law firm to set up his own law firm, to service his clients privately, and to keep the money for himself and his associates, and is operating it under a second name, or for that matter, the Mayor Brown name. No claim of trade secrets. There's just a claim of diversion of business and theft of partnership opportunities. Think anyone would deem that claim preempted?
I don't think so.
Why is this any different?
Because I think if under your scenario, if Mayor Brown came in and alleged that the only way that that partner was able to get information about the business he diverted was by using their trade secrets.
I've just said, forget about trade secrets. Your biggest problem on trade secrets is the district court said there were none. So I just want you to forget about trade secrets. If the partner in charge in Denver can just seize the offices, do his own business, and keep the money, no, it's so obviously a violation of fiduciary duties that it's not arguable. And I can't see how one would say, but the claim is preempted by Illinois law because Mayor Brown had no trade secrets. It can't win on a trade secret claim because it had none, and it can't win on any other claim because it had no trade secrets, and therefore the claim is preempted. That, of course, is your defense here. But HECME can't win on a trade secrets claim because it had none, and it can't win on any other claim because it's all preempted. Well, if you're going to be consistent with your own view, I think you have to answer my Mayor Brown question by saying that's preempted. But it doesn't look like you can swallow that, and neither can anybody else.
But, Your Honor, I think it would be, and I don't want to fight with you on forgetting about trade secrets, but your scenario would be a straight fiduciary duty case, and all of the fiduciary duty cases
that
you cited, I don't quibble with those. It's certainly possible that somebody who operates a business or
Mayor Brown adds, and he also sold one client file. Does that now excuse his fiduciary duty claim? You would now say Mayor Brown is limited to the damages from the theft of one client file. All the other damages are now preempted by Illinois law.
I agree that there is not blanket preemption.
Right. But then I don't understand how there's blanket preemption here. You don't seem to have the courage of your convictions.
I do, Your Honor, because it's a preemption of Heckney's own making. HECME is the master of its complaint. HECME is the master of its case. And HECME opted to put all of its eggs in one basket. And that basket is a theory that it was the predicate of the theory is that it was the use of their confidential information about HECME's customers that allowed the defendants to divert the business.
Is it confidential information if HECME gets a call saying that they're going to ship one product from one place to another? I mean, what's enough about the business to say more than that? And so they take that call, and then they shift that over to Platinum. And Platinum then goes and carries out the transaction, and then 20% or whatever they're doing, I don't know. Is that a trade secret, that call that came in?
I don't think so. I mean, the test for whether information is trade secret means, is it sufficiently secret and to have value?
It's just a call. Somebody called in the phone book, and instead of Heckman hearing it out, it was Platinum.
I don't think that would necessarily be right.
Isn't that what they're alleging?
On which part?
On breach of fiduciary duty.
What they're alleging on breach of fiduciary duty throughout is that the information that Heckney had about the nature of its business, about its customers, about the way it loads freight or who it sends freight to, that was confidential information that George Shue had in his head. And their claim, their theory, is that all of the defendants conspired together to misuse that confidential information for their purposes, to divert business. And it was Heckney that put itself in that predicament. I don't think it would be consistent with preemption law to wait to the end to determine, well, if they're not trade secrets, we'll let them go to the jury on an alternative theory. Preemption is a doctrine that applies at the beginning based on the pleadings and then now on summary judgment based on the evidence. I think the way to analyze this would be to look and see what it is that Heckney has claimed is a trade secret. And what have they sought damages for related to the trade secret? And then determine, is there anything left? And here again, the eggs in one basket. Heckney has claimed $1.2 million worth of damage for diverted business because of stealing trade secrets, and there is nothing left. There is no other damage in the record for any other conduct that Heckney has alleged as a breach of fiduciary duty.
Why would there have to be separate damage? I mean, lost profits is the appropriate measure of damages for all kinds of different claims.
The Trade Secrets Act speaks of remedies, and it displaces all remedies relating to any other common law cause of action.
Yeah, but you've already given that up in connection with the Lagarde hypothetical. You've already told me that, in your view, it does not displace remedies for standard breaches of fiduciary duty, stealing clients, diverting business, and so on.
That is true, Your Honor.
And the fact that there may be trade secrets on top still doesn't wipe out standard breaches, standard claims for breach of fiduciary duty.
I don't understand how your concession
is compatible with the argument you're now making, or indeed with the district court's opinion.
I agree there's no blanket preemption, and to the extent that a claim, a fiduciary duty claim or a conversion claim or a tortious interference claim, is based on the predicate theory that you sold trade secrets to be able to do it. For example, that it was the use of trade secrets that the fraud was your covering up the use of trade secrets, or the tortious interference as they claim here.
You answered my Maribel hypothetical the other way. Well, I gave you the case where the partner in charge did indeed steal one client file, and you said, but no, that wouldn't wipe out the fiduciary duty claim.
Well, at least it would as to that business.
No, it wouldn't.
If it would make
the tort worse, it doesn't excuse the breach of fiduciary duty.
But again, Mayor Brown would be the master of its complaint there. And if Mayor Brown came in and said, for the use of confidential information, he would not have known that file, then it would be based on trade secret theft. Now, if they came in with a different case and said, he just happened to work here and he happened to know our business and he stole it, that would be a fiduciary duty case. Heckney was the party that opted to pursue this as a trade secret case. And if I may, let me turn to the question that was asked.
What state case, in your view, gives you the most support for that position, which is that if somebody who is stealing business in violation of fiduciary duty also steals a trade secret, that essentially wipes out the fiduciary duty claim and remits the other party exclusively to a trade secret problem? What would be your best authority on that proposition?
You have me partially stumped, because I will admit that I've not focused on the state cases. The Burbank case that we cited...
The state cases are the only cases that matter.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that. And, you're left, again, as I mentioned, is this a question that would be appropriate to certify? I don't think so, because the law really is not complicated.
It isn't complicated. That's why I don't understand. If somebody, this is my simple example, somebody calls in with a piece of business, they want something shipped, whatever Heckney does, Pitney doesn't do it. Instead, Platten does, and they diverted. It was information that came in. Instead of fulfilling his obligation to Pitney, he transfers it, that business, to Platten.
Judge, to answer your question, what Heckney has claimed here, that opportunity,
that's a trade secret,
and that he misused that trade secret to divert the business. That is the case that Heckney...
That misnomer then gets you off the hook, at least under the preemption.
Heckney, this case has been litigated for now, if we don't remember, it'll be started its eighth year.
You can remind us of that.
That's an argument against certification.
Heckney did not assert trade secrets until somewhat later in the case, after they had seen the evidence. Now, from the very beginning, to try to justify no compete, they were alleging misuse of confidential information. So that has been in the case from the beginning. And then Heckney decided to amend to base all these claims and incorporate the claims and base them on trade secrets. And if I can...
There's no need to pursue this, but both sides seem to have this idea that one pleads law and you amend your pleadings to plead a new legal theory. One doesn't plead law. That's not the way the federal system works. If you have a new legal claim arising out of the facts, you don't amend your complaints.
At this point, now
legal theories appear in briefs.
But now you look at the record and you determine whether there's any damage that Heckney's identified that stands independent from their trade secret theory, and they don't. If I can answer, Judge Sykes asked the question, what are the trade secrets? And I think this is an important point. If you look at Heckney's brief at page 26, they cite the record 279, paragraph 160, for this proposition. Heckney says, Heckney presented evidence of trade secrets comprising customer lists and order details, pricing information, and computer software. And then they cite to two things in the record, R279, paragraph 160, which is their statement of undisputed facts, and A52, 23 to 26. Well, A52, 23 to 26 can be disposed of because that's their complaint. Those are unsupported allegations. If you follow the lead on R279, paragraph 160, that's their statement of uncontested facts. And to support that contention, the only evidence that Heckney points to support that they had trade secrets, is a deposition of one of my clients, Daisy Chu. And they cite to page 500 of her deposition. So their internal site is transcript, or TR20 at 500. And this is the evidence that Heckney cites to support its claim that there are trade secrets. Question, were quotations sometimes considered commercial secrets in the industry? Answer, I don't know. I think quotations maybe, probably mean free charge, I don't know. Question, and that is sometimes kept secret to the industry, right? Answer, I don't know. Question, have you ever known there to be any secrets in the industry? Answer, what do you mean? Question, do you sometimes keep information secret from your competitors? Answer, no. Presumably, Heckney cited the best evidence that they had to support their claim that they had trade secrets. That's the evidence that they cited. Now, if this court agrees, under Composite Marine and the other cases, that Heckney has not identified either trade secrets, reasonable steps to keep the information secret, or misuse by the defendants, the trade secret claim is gone. And with it, the $1.2 million of damage is gone. And the question is, what's left? And what would we be faced with if we have to go back to the trial court and say, okay, the trade secrets claim is gone, but is there some theory of fiduciary duty that should stand and that should go to the jury? And again, we're faced with a situation where Heckney opted to base all of its common law claims on the exact same theory, that it was the diversion of business, that it was the use and misuse of their vaguely defined confidential information that allowed the defendants to steal their business. Not a very well-developed claim. There's no evidence to support it, but that is the theory that Heckney opted to pursue. Is there further questions?
Would you address you've got a counterclaim, a third-party claim for a breach of fiduciary duty and something called aiding and abetting?
Yes, very briefly, Your Honor. George Hsu filed counterclaims against Heckney for breach of contract and for breach of fiduciary duty for not paying him his fair share of the profits. He also filed third-party claims against Heckney's parent company in Hong Kong for breach of fiduciary duty in its own right, as well as aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty. And the theory was that, and the evidence supports, that Heckney controlled the accounting. Both Heckney people in Los Angeles as well as Heckney people in Hong Kong controlled the accounting and controlled who got the share of the profits. Heckney has actually conceded that our counterclaim against Heckney should not have been dismissed. Heckney Limited, the Hong Kong entity, said we didn't submit sufficient facts to present a tribal issue on breach of fiduciary duty, and we think the record just refutes that. The record shows many, many instances of Heckney controlling the accounting and not paying George his fair share of the profits.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Anything further, Mr. Levinson?
Very briefly, George Chu did not need trade secrets to divert business, to pay our employees to work for competitors, to misappropriate our assets. He was there. He ran the business. We didn't put all our eggs in one basket. This is a 10-count complaint. It didn't even allege trade secrets.
I don't understand all these counts either. I mean, you can treat a complaint as if it were an indictment, and there would be a separate conviction on each count. You've got a couple of claims, perhaps.
I would agree that there are a couple of primary theories running through this. This is not a all-the-eggs-in-one-basket case, and our lost profits damage calculation was just that. Just very briefly on the counterclaim, since it came up, the allegation that Heckney Hong Kong, the parent in Hong Kong, is a fiduciary merely because it sets standards, accounting standards, set the accounting of its subsidiary, that doesn't create a fiduciary duty. And there's cases where accountants don't even have fiduciary duties to clients unless they do something special like recommend investments or conduct audits or the like. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.